CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear Ash Ahuja's disability story.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your disability story?
Yeah, my disability, so I was 11 years old, I'm 50 years old now. When I was 11, I got the flu, which was something that was going around. My entire family had it. And 2-3 days after the flu, I went for some blood work to the doctor's office since it wasn't getting better. And the doctor noticed that I was limping a little bit. So he's like, hey, go to a specialty doctor, like a neurosurgeon. And within a few hours that day, my limp went to inability to walk, to inability to stand, to complete paralysis, neck downward, within a day. In the ICU, in the hospital. So that happened when I was 11 years old. So this was, a diagnosis was not conclusive. Doctors thought all kinds of things, what has caused, but it was mostly the dengue fever, which is pretty prominent in India, which is where I was. And but it was, paralysis was neck downwards, both arms, both legs, everything. Except I never lost my sensory sensation anywhere. I could still feel everything. And over the next, I would say, 4 to 5 years with a lot of therapy, a lot of different treatments, Ayurveda, yoga, you name it, my parents took me to those things to try and see what can help. And it improved to a point where I use a wheelchair. I don't stand or walk because I don't have enough strength. But I do have some strength. So, like, now it's come to a point where, I would say, the last 34 years that I've been in a wheelchair, it's been, I'm independent. I as well. Now, I'm at it before. Pretty active, but still wheelchair bound.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your recovery? How did you keep yourself focused on recovering to the point at which you were able to at least use a chair?
Yeah, I would say since I was 11 when this happened, and what I found was first five odd years, it was almost 8 to 10 hours of therapy of all kinds that we were doing. Like, I would go to the therapist office, the OT, the physical therapy people, doing yoga at home, doing massages, Ayurveda. Like, it was nonstop. The entire day was just therapy. And I think it helped a lot. But after that, I would say I was spending so much time doing that I was feeling like I'm not living my life at all. And I think it came to a point where I think almost, you know, around 5-6 years after the incident, I felt like I've done enough. I want to start living life now. So then my focus was on being more active and independent and trying to do more things, go out more places, see friends, you know, do activities. So I think what helped me going is is more of that desire to live a more normal life and not spend all my time just doing therapy in the hopes that I'll walk again. My mindset was, walking is great, but it's not everything. I need to have a more normal life. And I'm pretty happy with that shift. And even now, I mean, I go through those ups and downs like anybody else, but I think I need to be working out more. Thankfully, for the last, I would say, 6 months or so, I've been doing that a lot more, working out more, building my strength. But there have been times where, you know, I put on weight and I don't think I'm working out as much. The thing that keeps me moving and driving is literally just wanting to be more out and about. So I've traveled a lot globally. That's something that I've loved doing a lot. I've done a lot more of that before COVID, not as much since then. But I've traveled a lot for fun, for work. I love driving as well. That was one of the first things, I think, which made me get a lot more confidence and a sense of independence when I started driving back in India. I think I was 18 or 19 when I started driving. And so that was a big motivator to, you know, see that, hey, this is something I can do. I can be independent. And what kind of strength do I need to maintain at least this level of mobility and improve it? So that's pretty much been the driver.
So in all your efforts, what's been the greatest success you've experienced? I know you have some connection to flight, for example.
Yeah, so I would say, the reason I was enamored by flight was because my dad was in the Air Force, in the Indian Air Force, since I was born. So I always saw him flying around, going for trips. Even my school in kindergarten was right next to a fighter Air Force base. So this was the Indian fighter training base where they would train fighter pilots. So, you know, even in sitting in school in kindergarten, you look out the window and you see these fighter jets taking off and landing all day long. And I would even know when my dad was flying at that airport that, oh, that's his plane. He's taking off and he's landing even while being at school. So I was always enamored by flight. Had I not gotten paralyzed, my dream would have been to also join the Air Force as a fighter pilot or as a test pilot. That was my dream. That got shot when I got paralyzed. So that didn't go too well. But then when I started driving a lot, even before I started flying, I was going on the racetrack. I've gone to racing schools back in Connecticut, Laguna Seca, that's here in California, but I forget the one in Connecticut. I've gone to that a bunch of times. And when I found out this wheelchair aviators group on the internet by chance, and that got me intrigued into figuring out, oh, wow, this is something people are doing. Let me find out more. What can I do? So it took me a lot of time trying to figure out how can I make this happen. And I even went to a flight school in Atlanta because I was going there for a lot of my consulting work. I was IT consulting back then. And I found this guy who trains World War veterans, war pilots, to get back into flying after they've had some kind of a spinal injury or amputation, things like that. So I met him, went for a test flight with him, really enjoyed it, but I didn't live in Atlanta, so I couldn't do it. Then when I moved to the East Coast in Connecticut, I found a school that opened up in New Jersey. And the minute I saw them, I signed up, and I think I was their first wheelchair pilot that they certified through that school. So I've just been on the lookout since it was my dream since being a kid just to get into flying.
So when you do fly, do you use any modified equipment or technique?
Yeah. So for flight, the biggest modification needed is for the rudder pedals, which are normally operated by feet for most normal pilots. And most planes have rudders and foot brakes as well. So those are things that you're doing with your feet, and the modifications that most of the planes that are flown need to have is a hand control modification where you can use one hand to control the stick or the yoke, which is to change the direction of flight in two axes, and the rudder is used for taxiing on the ground when you're moving on the ground, as well as the yaw motion when you're flying. And so for that, most planes that I've flown have a hand control adaptation that connects to the rudder pedals and gives you that control in your hands. And also because while flying, you need to control many things during, especially during critical phases of flight, like takeoffs and landings. You're controlling the ailerons, the elevators, the rudders, the power, the flaps. There's a lot of things going on. And if you only have two hands, you want to be able to do it all with two hands. So most of the planes have hand controls where the rudder and the throttle is in one hand, so you can use one hand to do both of those actions, and the other hand is on the stick that you use to control the direction of flight in two axes. And then some planes that I've used even have the throttle on your hand, so with your thumb you can change the throttle. So there's multiple modifications. The plane that I have has the rudder and the throttle on my right hand, and I use the regular yoke, which is used to control the direction of flight with my left hand. And the last modification that they have is putting on hand brakes that I can use while I'm on the ground. So when you're taxiing the plane or after you land back and you want to taxi back to the hangar, you use those brakes along with the rudder and throttle. So those adaptations have been made in the plane that I have and also the other planes that I've flown.
I thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us an update on Thrive Magazine. So what's the latest with Thrive?
Hi, Cam. It's excitingly, we are now moving from a three-time-a-year publication. It's a little bit awkward. It's typically, you know, once a year, twice a year, four times a year. So we are moving to a four-time-a-year publishing format. That fourth issue, too, which I'm really excited about, is a little bit different than the others in that it's going to be a resource guide for the community. That being people, amputees like myself, those living with limb loss or limb difference, and for families, practitioners, healthcare professionals, just information that can help people when they're beginning the journey of limb loss, but also, you know, hacks and tips and tricks that seasoned amputees have learned along the way. So that's going to be our last one on the schedule in the fall that will be released.
So why the transition to a four times a year model, and what do you hope to achieve by increasing the numbers there?
Well, in my world and yours too, content creation is, we're content creators, right? And we always like to create more if we can. But we did find this gap in information in that. That more resource type content that I described. I mean, the magazines, the other three have profiles, and we have a section called Mind Over Matter, which is, you know, spiritual in the sense of mindfulness and, you know, centering and just being more mentally healthy, for sure. And of course, we review different products, but we find that the ABT community has as much information as folks might think there is out there in the internet world. Sometimes it's hard to find, sometimes it's hard to sift through, particularly for our older readers. So we want to bring that to them in a one-stop shop sort of approach, and giving them the tools that they can refer to at any time, this year, next year, just a real resource, a tool for them.
So, that being said, I'm guessing it's going to include some tips and resources for dealing with the mental health side of having a limb loss or a limb difference, because the start of that journey, as I've covered many times, can be just overwhelming and that sense of shock.
Definitely. I mean, there's the grief component that people go through with loss of a limb, you know, that can be followed by social isolation, with our own implicit biases, stereotypes, and assumptions. We can't help that. Our brains are wired that way, and the influences and the lenses that have shaped that can be cultural, religious, personal experiences. So all of a sudden, someone ends up being an amputee, being in the disability community, that they may have real stereotypes or biases or assumptions about, and we really want to try and help them get past that social stigma that they might be experiencing. I mean, for any new amputee, staring is problematic at first, and for some all their life. Helping folks understand that, that there's difference now, but that can be embraced and I don't say appreciated, that'd be, I'm looking for a different word to explain that, but to help them get through those initial struggles of living differently in a world that they once knew.
So, sort of a way of looking at compensating. You can't do it one way, but you might be able to change it to be done another.
Yeah, definitely, and that's, I think across the board in the disability community, we're great adapters, compensators. I've heard it said we're the best problem solvers in the world, and I certainly know that as a double arm amputee. You run into a slippery round doorknob for me, and right away I need to be thinking, okay, how am I going to manage that getting in? And if it's a restroom door, getting out as well, and just different ways of getting through our everyday daily living activity. So and that changes once become an amputee, being an upper extremity, an arm amputee, or a lower extremity, where mobility and fatigue and pain now become much more prevalent in their life.
So, do you have any advice to any new amputees out there for ways they can sort of keep their head above water and start looking at the world from the standpoint of what's possible?
Yeah, and where would I start with that? I think most importantly, and just to step back, a lot of people feel very alone after they lose the limb, like they're the only ones in Canada or wherever, their town, their village, their city. There is that feeling of the disconnection, for sure. And peer support, and maybe expanding on that a little bit, appropriate peer support, finding someone that is like them, that to talk to and see where they are on their journey. Finding someone of the same age, same gender, same interests, and that can be done through amputee support groups, through their prosthetists, through rehabilitation professionals. Really important to seek the company, and I don't always say advice, but company of others that are a little bit further down that path or that journey.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Always a pleasure, Cam. Thank you.
Of course. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
You're missing a couple of strings on this bass guitar. Is that how you learned it, and you never bothered to buy two new ones, or is there a plan?
After 2 years, I mean, what's the point spending money on a lottery? It's like two is enough. It's adequate. Anybody can play this bass.
Revolution Rock airs Saturday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. on CJAM 99.1 FM in the Windsor, Detroit area.
We are a syndicated award-winning radio show that broadcasts 60s garage rock, 70s punk and new wave, surf, alternative, indie, and old and new music within these genres.
You can also hear us online at cjam.ca, iHeartRadio, and visit our website at revrock.blogspot.com.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Ash Ahuja shared a little bit of his disability story, and we heard the latest from Thrive Magazine from Jeff Thiessen.
In this segment of our show, David Taylor will be telling us a little bit about ALS Canada.
So what's the latest with ALS Canada?
Well, from our organization's standpoint, and I think what hopefully, you know, your listeners would be really interested in is that we're currently pushing very hard to try to have the Ontario government support the organization's care and support mechanisms, as well as their access to multidisciplinary care through clinics across the province of Ontario. So we've got a big ask in, and we're very excited. We're advocating for it. We're going to be in Queen's Park this coming week, and we're very hopeful that this can do a lot to support Ontarians living with ALS.
So for those who might not be as familiar, what are some of the most common barriers facing an ALS patient?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is I'm actually not the best person to ask, even though I have been in it for a long time. I would say asking a person who's living with ALS is the best person to ask, because they're going to be, you know, really be able to tell you what it's like, because I certainly, you know, can sympathize, but I'll never know what it is that they truly have to go through. But it, really, it's from the moment of diagnosis, a person who maybe never heard of the disease, doesn't know where to go, needs to find information. Do they want to participate in research? How do they get the right type of care? Are they getting the right type of care? And then they have barriers in terms of getting access to great care. That's what we're asking the government to help support, because we need better multidisciplinary care at the clinics. We know that that's a great model. And then as the disease progresses, it, you know, every day is a new hurdle and a new step as it progresses. And that comes with it, obviously, physical things to deal with, but also, you know, the psychological aspects that it takes as a toll on an individual, on a family. Money is another issue. It's a very expensive disease in a lot of ways. And, for a lot of people who may have to leave work or leave jobs, caregivers who might have to leave jobs, it can be incredibly difficult for individuals. But I'd say they would know better than I would any day of the week.
So what are some of the supports your organization provides to those affected?
Yeah, so our organization has a really robust community service program. So we actually have individuals known as community leads who are in different areas around the province. They will, once registered with us, they will go into the homes. They'll help navigate all the local systems. I myself, if I was diagnosed with ALS, I wouldn't know what the local things are in my area that can provide me that support. We also have an equipment pool, so we will be able to help coordinate across the province for people to get anything from walkers, other mobility aids, wheelchairs, lifts, things to help with stairs, all kinds of different things that can help them to manage the journey. And then there are support groups, there are webinars that are offered for information, and then our organization has a whole other mandate around research and advocacy. But from the day-to-day for individuals, I think our community services is really where we shine for Ontarians who are diagnosed with the disease.
So how do you reach out to the patient community?
Yeah, so in various ways, we have all kinds of communications. We do through social media. We obviously have a website. We're rebuilding a website. We try to do as much awareness, like yourself, who can opportunities to get the word out. When someone is diagnosed, we really try to make sure we have a good and strong connection with the clinics so that they will explain to them that we exist. Those individuals can then register with us, and then we can absolutely start the process of getting involved in helping them in whatever way they choose to and whatever way they need.
So, in your time with ALS Canada, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yeah, oh, there have been lots of success stories. So I've been with ALS Canada for about 12 years. I'm actually the national VP for research. And so from a research standpoint, we've come an incredibly long way in our understanding of the disease. We now have some more approved therapies, but I think we're on the way to more robust therapies. So that's an exciting piece, because once we can start to weave that in alongside the support and care, this is when we can make a difference on actually slowing down the progression of the disease someday, maybe even stopping or curing it. But even from a standpoint of what we can provide and what we can do, you know, we've been able to achieve certain advocacy goals of having extension of compassionate care benefits alongside other charities. We have there are better benefits for certain military individuals who may carry a slightly higher risk for ALS. And we are really hopeful that this provincial ask that goes in to help people both get better care, provide better care for people in northern and rural areas of Ontario, and then to allow our equipment program and our community services to be covered by the province, not by donors. We're really excited and think that this has a great chance of potentially moving forward, and that would be a massive, massive win.
So what would the ideal outcome be for this ask? If you could see anything added to the existing services and what's available for ALS patients, what would you like to see?
Yeah, right now the ask is really focused on $6.6 million a year, which would come out of the provincial budget to be able to support. So if someone is diagnosed with ALS, they will have a certain set of funds that help them, that follow them around to the clinics, in the sense that it will help to boost what clinics can provide. So the best model of ALS care is widely known around the world as multidisciplinary care. Actually, an interesting story, because it came largely out of a gentleman in London, Ontario, as well as someone in San Francisco many, many years ago. But the care is not still perfect, in the sense that it takes a lot of infrastructure and a lot of different individuals with different expertise to do this proper multidisciplinary care. So the funding would actually help boost the clinics to be able to do that. It would also offset completely our community services and equipment program, and make sure that provisions are better for people in rural areas, which would allow us so much more funds to be able to do valuable research and ultimately be able to find better disease-modifying therapies. So yeah, the $6.6 million would just be an incredible change in how ALS is approached in this province, and across the country with what it will leverage.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. In disability life, my friends, the key is always adaptation, finding what works for you. Now, it's not up to anyone to tell you that you can't have this dream or that dream, that you can't achieve this or that goal. For someone like Ash, who found a unique and creative way to still do what he loves to do, this is a great example. Because honestly, in disability life, it all comes down to determination, deciding what you want to do and what might make it possible to get there. Yeah, a lot of times you're going to hear everyone's perception of what you should and should not be able to do. People love sharing that opinion. But honestly, they don't know your strength. They don't know you as a person. They don't know what you have achieved, nor what you will achieve. It's up to each one of us to establish that for ourselves. Oh yes, we can choose to live with the glass ceiling idea. We can choose to take someone saying, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you don't move this way or see that way. We can choose to take that as gospel. We can let it become set in stone and hold us back. My question is simply, why? Why would anyone limit themselves to that? For the fact is, we can't know what's possible and what's not until we get out there and try it for ourselves. Honestly, that is the very basis of progress. People love to point out what doesn't work in the world. I think in disability life, we're about finding ways of making things work. Perhaps it's true we don't do things in the way others would expect, but if it works, I think it's the result that counts most of all. And disability life is all about thinking outside the box, using our creativity. If you need a hammer and you don't have one, use a pipe. But honestly, each one of us is responsible for figuring out our own hopes and dreams, deciding whether or not we're going to take a chance to get there. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.